This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, writer J. Courtney Sullivan on her novel The Engagement, and then critic Robert Hanks talks about Comedians by Trevor Griffiths. J. Courtney Sullivan is the author of the New York Times best-selling novels Commencement, Maine, and The Engagements. Maine was named a Best Book of the Year by Time magazine and a Washington Post Notable Book for 2011. The Engagements was one of People magazine's top 10 books of 2013 and an Irish Times Best Book of the Year. It is seen to be a major motion picture produced by Reese Witherspoon. Courtney's writing has also appeared in the New York Times Book Review, Chicago Tribune, Elle, Glamour, and the New York Observer, among many others. And she was co-editor with Courtney Martin of the essay anthology Click, When We Knew We Were Feminists. So Courtney, welcome to Little Atoms, first of all.
Thank you for having me.
It's your book, The Engagements, that we're going to be talking about today. It's just come out in paperback in the UK in January. So let's talk, first of all, about what's this book about? Tell us what the story is, or what do you think it's about, I guess I should ask.
What do I think it's about? It's really the story of four different marriages. They all take place in different decades. I started writing it thinking about how same-sex marriage laws were in the news quite a bit in the States, and people who were opposed to same-sex marriage kept saying, you can't change marriage, you can't change marriage. It's sort of the, you know, this fundamental thing that if you make a change to it, the whole society will crumble. Mm-hmm. When in fact we know that marriage has changed drastically from one decade to the next. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I started thinking, well, it's only a little over 40 years ago that a black man and a white woman could not marry in this country, that a woman needed a husband's permission to have a credit card. And so I thought, well, how did these bigger picture ideas sort of shape the lives of individuals? So I wanted to write about marriage over the course of a century. Mm-hmm. And then from a character perspective, I think, you know, all novelists have a sort of nosy quality about us. And you never really know what's happening in someone else's marriage. It was quite intriguing from the writing perspective to really delve into these four marriages. Well, one isn't a marriage. It's just a relationship, I guess.
But there is a marriage in that story.
There is a marriage in the story. That's right. And then the sort of overlay of all these characters who do connect in some of them in small ways, some of them in large ways, eventually in the book. The overlay was this character, Frances Garrity, who was based on a real person. She was a copywriter in the 1940s who wrote the iconic line, "A diamond is forever," for De Beers. Because I always wanted to include diamonds in this story about marriage, as they are one of the things that have sort of stayed a constant through the last many, many decades.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk first of all then about the four groups of people, the four marriages or relationships. And we'll get on to Frances after we've done that. So tell us a little bit more about those four characters. Why you settled on those people, I guess. Why you chose to write about people in their particular situation.
So each of them was really distinctive, and I think Evelyn. So Evelyn and Gerald are living in the early 70s in the book. It's 1972, I believe, and they've been married over 40 years. They have a pretty blissful existence. They're quite affluent. They have a very harmonious marriage. Their only sort of strife comes from the fact that their adult son, who's not really their favorite person in the world, is divorcing their daughter-in-law, who really is their favorite person. And this is sort of heartbreaking for Evelyn in particular. And so it's funny. So these two, you know, there's another kind of aspect to their story, which is how they met. Mm-hmm. And for each of the couples in the book, I really wanted to look at, because I wanted to look at everything that happens in a marriage, all the things that can possibly go wrong and all the things that can go right, and also why we get married in the first place. So each of these couples got married for a very different reason and came together in very different ways. So Evelyn and Gerald, their meeting story is actually based on a couple I met at a wedding about 10 years ago.
Wow.
My first friends to get married, they got married really young, and I was sitting at a table with this elderly couple. I think they were probably in their 70s or 80s. And, you know, they were talking about how the bride and groom had met, and then we started talking about, you know, how other people had, the crazy stories of how people had met. And so, of course, I asked them, well, how did you meet? And the woman said, just kind of very casually, well, actually, when I was very young, in my early 20s, I was married to another man, and he passed away, And this was his best friend, and we ended up getting married. You know, I think as novelists do, you tend to sort of collect stories like that as you move along and think, eventually I might want to write about that. I'm not exactly sure how or why. They really intrigued me because I could tell that they were very happily married. They've obviously been married for 60 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they met, to them, is probably not that fascinating. You know, it's just how they met. But to someone like me, hearing it for the first time, of course, that's really kind of a shocking thing. And I remember this woman saying, and I put this into Evelyn's, one of her chapters, that, you know, she said it was very natural. It didn't feel like this shocking thing. They didn't think that her first husband would have been shocked. They, in fact, thought he would be happy, and that she still had presents from her first wedding, you know, that she was using in her house now 60 years later, because they didn't pretend that that man didn't exist. In fact, they thought that would be very odd, you know, since they both had really kind of loved him.
So that seems normal to them. It seems the right thing to do to that couple, but other people around them think it's odd. And what I think is so great about that strand of the story is it's ostensibly about her. She's at this point in the book in 1972, perhaps a little fuddy-duddy, a bit of a sort of stick in the mud, and she's shocked.
Yeah.
Not just that her son wants to leave his wife and children, but he wants to get a divorce, and that seems anathema to her that he wants to get a divorce.
Yeah.
So it's looking at the sort of change in attitudes towards divorce.
Yeah.
But she's also oblivious to the fact that other people around her at the time were shocked by what they did in the first place.
That's right. That's right. That's a really good point. I actually never thought of that. That's a really good point. Yeah. And, you know, I think the other thing about Evelyn and her time period is that when we usually read about characters living in 1972, I feel like they're usually, you know, wearing bell bottoms and changing the world. And Evelyn's not that. She's a woman in her mid-60s. She's sort of, like, done with her big changes in life with, you know, really the evolution of her mind. And she's a good-hearted person, so she's curious about these things. She's interested in these things, but she's also not sure what she thinks about them. And I think that that really probably would be indicative of a woman like her at that time. You know, it's 1972, so interracial marriage is a new thing in the United States, which is sort of shocking to think of now. And she's sort of, like, she's curious about it. She's not really sure exactly how she feels about it.
So the next couple, James and Sheila.
Yes. James and Sheila. So James is a paramedic and his wife Sheila is a nurse. And they are at that stage of marriage. I mean, they're really sort of foils to Evelyn and Gerald in a way because they struggle financially so much. And they're in a much earlier stage of marriage, so their kids are young. Everything is craziness. You know, it's just mayhem around them all the time. They work a lot. Their kids take up a lot of energy, and they don't really have time for each other. They really barely even see each other. In fact, work opposite schedules. And he's just kind of struggling, you know? He's struggling. When I was writing James, he works in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which I really wanted to get at the difference. I wanted all the characters to be from different socioeconomic backgrounds and of different ages. And for him, there's a sort of added layer to that, which is that he's a paramedic in Cambridge, where you have the richest of the rich and the poorest of the poor and Harvard and all these things mixed in together in one city. And as a paramedic, of course, you just are constantly seeing different kinds of people every half hour. You know, it's a crazy thing. So I went and did several ambulance ride-alongs with the medics in Cambridge to see what their daily life is like. Some of these guys really inspired a lot of the ways that James is, because I talked to them and they were very open about sort of what you do with the emotions that come along with some of the very gruesome things that they see on a day-to-day basis.
Is that one also, I was going to suggest, that one sort of milieu closer to your own background as well, perhaps? The sort of the Irish Catholic thing.
The Irish Catholic, yeah, sort of, yes. And that's another thing. Yeah, I can never get away from that. So with my first novel, I had one character who was Irish Catholic. My second novel was about a big Irish Catholic family. This one I said, okay, no more Irish Catholics. But I couldn't stop myself. So James and also Francis, of course, is Irish Catholic.
Yeah, set in Boston. Well,
yes. Right.
The next couple, well, Delphine, I guess, we should talk about, because it's not, there's two couples involved in this next story. So tell us about Delphine.
Yeah, okay. So Delphine, she is this beautiful Parisian woman who marries, she works in antique and rare musical instruments and shares a business with this slightly older man, and they end up married, and it's almost like baffling to her that they're married, you know. And I think this is one of the things that as you get older, like when I was a kid, I always puzzled over how is it that so many people end up divorced? How do they suddenly wake up one day and the person is not who they married? Which of course does happen, but I think another thing that happens that I didn't realize is sometimes we just marry the wrong people. And maybe you even kind of know it, you know. People often say this, well, I kind of had a feeling early on, but I didn't listen to it. And Delphine's kind of like that, you know. She knows, well, there's not a lot of passion here. I'm not madly in love with him, but he's safe and he's very kind and I see him every day anyway. So, okay, you know, and she ends up marrying him. And of course, several years down the road, there's even less passion than there was in the beginning. And this young man comes into her life. That's nothing but passion. And she has to decide what she's going to do about that. Ends up leaving the husband for him, with semi-disastrous consequences. But yeah, her story, of course, is the story, you know, of infidelity and that aspect of marriage. I think these characters all, in some way, tend to relate back to their parents, you know, because it's so much about generations and how marriage has changed from one generation to the next. Delphine has this very complicated relationship, you know, with her father who has passed away, who she loves so much, and is kind of, she just feels sort of untethered without him being in the world, really. So I think she almost doesn't even feel like what she's doing is, is real in a strange kind of a sense. You know, this is sort of true for all of the characters, that they're reacting in some way. So, like, with James, his father never really being on the scene, you know, dying when he was very young, he's so protective of his mother, and he's also so protective of his marriage, but knows that he doesn't really have any sort of model for it.
The final couple then, Kate and Dan. We mentioned that Evelyn's story was set in 1972. Each of these are set in a different period. So James and Sheila's is in the late 80s. Delphine is in the early 2000s. And Kate and Dan are sort of roughly contemporary, roughly sort of present day. For that reason, but also for various other reasons, I think these were my favourite couple because I just know those people. I know so many people that are like that. These two are not married.
Right.
Now, why are they not married?
They, well, you know, this is, I think, like I was saying about the parents, Kate is probably the strongest example of this. She was raised in the 80s. You know, her parents were divorced. It was a really bitter divorce. And most of her friends' parents are divorced too. And she's thinking, well, why would I do that? This is an institution that just doesn't work. So why should we keep doing it? Whereas her sister has taken this very traditional path and is trying to have this do-over on their parents' marriage and make it perfect. You know, so they've each gone in a very different direction. But yeah, I think Kate feels, and it's not a very American way to feel, actually, that, you know, marriage is just not necessary anymore. And it frustrates her that in many countries that's sort of understood, whereas in the U.S. it's really not. But they have a child and they actually have a very traditional life. In fact, in some ways more traditional and more healthy than a lot of the other couples in the book. But because they are not married, it sort of haunts them. Their families are constantly saying, why aren't you married? And trying to sort of force them to do it.
And the idea that people don't take it quite as seriously because
they're not married.
So I thought she was, I said, I know people exactly like Kate. She's so well realised. And she's one of those, she's a, works for an NGO and they eat organic food and stuff. But she's one of those people that just teeters on the edge of, you know, she's very, very good and earnest. And makes everybody around her feel a bit worse about themselves.
She's so, you know, and I really struggle with writing her because I like her and I don't want her to be too self-righteous, but she can't help herself. You know, she knows that she's this way. She knows she's kind of annoying, but she just can't help it. And she's constantly, you know, I think because the book is so much about marriage, and I know we'll talk about this later, about diamonds, she's sort of the one voice in the book saying, wait, we need to examine these things. You know, everyone else is just living and moving through their lives, but we need to examine, why do we want these things and what do they mean and all of that. But she can't ever quiet the voices in her head that are making her worry about, you know, plastic and her daughter wearing princess dresses and the Kardashians and all of these things. You know, they just plague her.
And as I mentioned, Kate and Dan are not married, but their story is set around the marriage of Jeff and Toby. Two men. So tell us why you decided to explore that through this other couple.
Yeah, so like I said, when I started writing the book, same-sex marriage was in the news a lot, and it had just been legalized in New York where I live. And so part of me just really wanted to write that wedding, that one of those first weddings that would happen, because it's such a historic moment. It's such an exciting moment. But also, I really wanted Kate to have this sort of counterpoint. So Jeff, who's her best friend and also her cousin, has always been the one person who kind of agreed with her, yes, marriage is outdated. But the second he's able to do it himself, he, in fact, literally, like, as he's watching the law change is when he proposes and they change their minds. And so I think I wanted her to kind of be, you know, feel like, oh my God, she's sort of an island now, but she's still trying to be happy for him. You know, I think above even her sort of dislike for marriage is her complete hatred of weddings. You know, and Jeff is kind of a bit of a bridezilla, so she's trying to sort of negotiate who he's become and what this is all about. And also, you know, I think the world doesn't need one more woman bridezilla character, mm-hmm. but like I loved the idea of a man becoming really so obsessed with all the details of a wedding, and so that was sort of where that all came from.
I'm Andrew McConnell Stott, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
The other character that we've not really mentioned yet is Mary Frances Geraghty. Mm-hmm. Now, in the second part of the show, we'll talk a bit more about her and her milieu. But I want to know, first of all, how differently was it for you writing about a historical character against writing about all of the fictional characters and all of the other stories? What are the essential differences?
Because I have a background in journalism, mm-hmm. I think that was part of it. And also because I really just came to be so fond of her through the writing process. I wanted to be as true to who she was as I possibly could. And so, you know, for each of these characters, there was a level of research that went into mm-hmm. kind of fleshing them out. But for Frances, there's an enormous amount of research. I wanted the reader to feel like they were actually learning about this person mm-hmm. and not, you know, so often I feel like when I read a book that I know is based on a real person, mm-hmm. I'm wondering, did this really happen? Did that really happen? And with Frances, I can tell you that everything happened. You know, every scene in that book really did happen. Her dog's name is Blazer because her dog's name was Blazer. You know, she drinks martinis because she drank martinis. I mean, there was some review of the book where they kind of criticized that I had her drinking so many martinis and saying, no one drinks that many martinis. Well, she really did. But yeah, you know, I think especially because she's not some historic figure, she's not Marie Antoinette. You know, mm-hmm. she is a person who you would not otherwise be hearing about. And there, in fact, had been nothing written about her prior to this. So I felt really sort of indebted to mm-hmm. getting it right and to her.
Is there, I guess, again, from a journalistic point of view, we could look at it from that perspective, do you have more of a responsibility? Do you feel more of a responsibility in presenting her in a way? Because, you know, the other people are out of your head, ostensibly, yes. but there may well be people still alive that knew the person
yes,
that you're
absolutely,
writing about.
Absolutely. And she was a very solitary person in some ways. She mm-hmm. didn't marry, she didn't have children, and she was, I don't want to say a loner, but she was a bit of a loner. So, and she mm-hmm. passed away in the 90s. So, you know, at first I wasn't really sure how to even get at her, but I ended up interviewing about a dozen of her former coworkers, and some of them, you know, knew her very well, and some, you know, she would now be about 100 years old or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, most of her contemporaries are not available to speak unless you are using a medium, I guess, or something. So, you know, some of these people only had little anecdotes about her, but even through that, I was able to piece something together. Mm-hmm. And then I visited her home and got to really sort of like just be in the space where she had lived and meet her neighbors who remembered her. And of course, people you worked with will remember you in a very different way than people who lived right next door to you and all of this. So I felt like over time, I had a fuller picture of who mm-hmm. she really was. And there's nothing she says in the book or even really thinks in the book, for the most part, that doesn't come from a letter she wrote or an interview she gave. Mm-hmm. She gave a very long interview to someone in-house at the advertising agency where she worked. They had like a historian on staff. Mm-hmm. So a lot of her thoughts in the book come from that interview.
Tell me a bit more about the research process across the whole book. You mentioned riding in the ambulances with the paramedics a little bit. What other sort of things did you do?
Yeah, so with the paramedics, it was funny because I had gone on several ride-alongs when it dawned on me that James is a medic in 1987 and his life would be completely different. You know, the technology is so different. So then I had to go back and interview a lot of medics who had actually been mm-hmm. there at that time, the time that he started, which is the late 70s mm-hmm. and kind of technology at that time because of what they were learning from Vietnam. I mean, it was really restructuring what it meant to be a paramedic, mm-hmm. Really going from literally just picking people up and driving them to the hospital to actually doing something, you know, and knowing how to save them, but with very little technology.
Mm-hmm. So and you also talk about the different agencies that did that. That was interesting. In fact, this yes. happens all through the book. I meant to mention in terms of talking about, you know, the research and the time periods are very vividly recreated, but very interestingly often through that. So you talk about the changing roles of how, you know, who were paramedics and, yes. who did that as well.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting because I think, you know, as a writer, one of the main reasons to be a writer mm-hmm. is that you get to just peer into these worlds that you never would otherwise. Mm-hmm. You know, I would never have an immersion in being a paramedic except that I wrote this character. And there are these fascinating elements to every type of career and every type of life. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like you're talking about, I mean, one of the medics I interviewed said, that you look at these pictures of old ambulances and they look like hearses. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that they look like hearses is because some of them actually were hearses, mm-hmm. that the funeral homes would have an agreement with the hospital that we will pick up these really sick people, deliver them to you, they will probably die, and then we'll bring them back to our funeral home. I mean, it's horrible because the rate of people who did die in an ambulance on the way to the hospital was just enormously high before all of these innovations, which is, who knew? You know, I never thought about that. So for each of the characters, there was something kind of fun like that. So for Delphine, because she works with instruments, and in particular, there's the Stradivarius violin that her husband owns, I was in touch with this wonderful violin soloist named Anna Kiko Myers, and she owns two Stradivarius violins. So I just wanted to talk to her about that. And then the more I talked to her, the more I became fascinated by her and by her story. Mm-hmm. And so PJ, Delphine's boyfriend, is, you know, a violin prodigy, essentially, as Anna Kiko Myers is. And they have nothing in common as far as their personalities or their lives. You know, he's kind of this awful cad, and Anna Kiko Myers is this, like, stunningly gorgeous mother of two. But what they have in common is that they were so talented so young, and no one else in their families were, and so kind of what that does to a young person. So from her, I was able to sort of gather a lot, and she was so wonderfully helpful. It was really funny because I would call her with these little tiny questions, and her husband's a musician too. And at a certain point, I felt they were so lovely and so invested in this book. Like, I called her and I said, so, you know, there's this woman who lives upstairs from Delphine's father when she's a child. Her name's Madame Delacorte. And what kind of songs would she want him to play on the piano when her friends come over? And she's just like yelled up to her husband, what song would we get for Madame Delacorte during lunch or something? And he knew, like, what she was talking about. I just loved that. There was no context needed. They were really right there with me in the story, which was lovely.
I'm really pleased that you mentioned that thread, because my absolute favourite example of the research thing is the story that Henry tells about the anecdote about this theory about the Stradivarius and the density of the wood.
Yeah.
And I'd only just a few months ago seen that on a television programme or a thing, and so I was really delighted that it came up in this thing, and it's really interesting. But I also love the way in which you present it as it's a sort of slightly boring anecdote that he's telling too late at a dinner party when he's gone on about the violin for far too long. I thought that was a really great touch.
Right, he can never stop talking about it.
Just finally for this part then, tell us, it's probably not a great deal we can talk about this, but what's happening about the film development? Whereabouts is that at?
Yeah, so that now is with a really amazing screenwriter who's writing the screenplay and I think pretty close to finishing it. Mm-hmm. And then the next step is going to a director, going to actors they're interested in and seeing. So Reese Witherspoon and her company are producing. Mm-hmm. It's a division of 20th Century Fox that's producing it, or that's the studio that's creating it. It's called Fox 2000. So I think things are proceeding along.
Listed to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. This week I'm talking to J. Courtney Sullivan, and we're talking about her novel, The Engagements. So, Courtney, in this second part of the show, I want to take, first of all, a closer look at Frances Geraghty, the character, but also the world that she inhabited, which was the world of advertising. People will be familiar from, I guess, Mad Men, that sort of Madison Avenue advertising executive type thing. But in this context, we're talking about a company, N.W. Ayer, who shun New York. They're based in Philadelphia.
Yes.
So let's talk about that world, that company, first of all. Who was that company?
Yeah, so they're a fascinating company. And in a way, I think N.W. Ayer almost became a character in the story because this was another element of the research, you know, making sure that my research on Frances was accurate, extended to N.W. Ayer, and almost all of the characters in the N.W. Ayer chapters are real people, which is kind of fun. But N.W. Ayer was this really curious agency. There's some debate about this, but they were either the first or second, depending who you ask, advertising agency ever. They created this idea that you're not just selling you know, the advertising space, but you're actually creating the ad. And prior to them doing that, a company would just do it on their own, you know. They had a very sort of, like, puritanical, sort of Midwestern personality, and they were incredibly successful for many, 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 many decades. When the New York thing started, and these bigger companies like J. Walter Thompson began, which I think is sort of what Mad Men is based on, they just, especially the head of NWA, because he was a man, they were based in Philadelphia, and he was a man who loved Philadelphia. He was just crazy about Philadelphia. He was always, like, you know, supporting whoever's the local mayor and, you know, getting his support behind revitalizing, you know, areas. And he just didn't believe that New York was going to be sort of the center of the universe for advertising. And one of the reasons why he thought that was he thought that these good sort of American companies, like if it's Ford or it's, you know, some, like a cosmetics company or a food company or whatever it might be, they wanted their advertising agency to be more in touch with what normal Americans are like. And New York is not in touch with what Americans are like. So he totally miscalculated that one. And, of course, NWA, they eventually did go to New York, but it was sort of a mess. And they now no longer exist. But at the time that Francis was working, they were sort of the be-all, end-all in advertising.
So let's talk about Francis and her story, where she came from and what she did. And she's presents in this book, and she's a real life character, so what she represents is not just somebody who did a, you know, an amazing thing in advertising that has become famous and sort of resonated through the ages, but also she's there at that point where she's, you mentioned this idea that, you know, she was a spinster ostensibly, you know, if that's still the right description. She lived on her own. She represents the beginning of the career woman and the subsequent sacrifices that women were expected to make to be career women.
Yes. Yeah, and certainly that's changed, you know, in a lot of ways. I mean, now you can work in advertising and get married, but really, in her day, you really did have to choose. You could work in advertising, but if you were a woman, if you got married, then you were pretty much done. You know, you were not going to continue working. She was kind of fascinating because, you know, because Mad Men is so popular and we think about these pioneering women, like the Peggy Olson types who came along in the 60s, but, you know, Frances was working in the late 30s in advertising. And Dorothy Dignam, who's another character in the book, who's also a real person, she was writing advertising starting during World War I. So it's actually pretty amazing. You know, women were always there. But they were definitely hired to write from the woman's point of view, with the understanding that men could just never fathom, you know, what it was that was inside of a woman's head.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because people were reluctant to have women working, but at the same time, they needed them.
Exactly.
So they were there because they needed the woman's perspective to sell to women.
Exactly.
And presumably, selling became more important than keeping women out of the workplace.
Yes, and in fact, when Frances applied at NWA, you know, she was told, oh, you're in luck, we've just lost a female copywriter. You know, so it really came right down to that. And she was interesting because Dorothy, she, in real life and in the book, she was someone who really actually sort of understood this need for women coming together. And, you know, she was very big in, like, the Women in Advertising Association and, you know, always talking about what this meant. And also she thought it was really funny. You know, she had a list of questions that men asked her every day and she would write them down. And those are now in her archive at Radcliffe. Frances, on the other hand, was really more just about Frances. She wanted to work. She did not want to be married. She took care of her parents into their old age. And I don't think she was thinking about womankind. She was just thinking about Frances, you know. So she wasn't as much of a sort of joiner, I guess, as Dorothy.
So let's talk about the tagline,
You
know, what she came up with.
Yes. So this is kind of the funny part, though, I think. You know, when we think about the fact that these women were hired to write for other women, because only women can understand women, of course. But Frances and Dorothy had nothing in common with the average American woman. Neither of them ever married. And I think if they had married, I can't imagine them wearing a diamond ring, you know? But they were the people responsible for De Beers selling so many diamond engagement rings. So when De Beers first came to NWA, their problem was that women in America and worldwide were not wearing diamonds. The diamond engagement ring was just seen as something for the ultra wealthy. And for a normal woman to wear one would just be sort of impossible. And, you know, Frances has a great line in that interview where she says that they did all these surveys and they found that women would rather have a washing machine or really anything than a diamond ring. It just seemed like money down the drain. And so the job of NWA and Frances in particular was sort of to create, because there isn't a reason to have a diamond, you know, you can't drive it or eat it or whatever. So was to create this intense emotional attachment to the diamond engagement ring and make it seem like something. This was sort of a very new idea in advertising at the time. Rather than saying, this is new, almost creating the myth that it always had been that way, mm-hmm. and that it was a tradition, and that you couldn't do anything but that tradition, and mm-hmm. if you did, that would be terrible, yeah. you know? And in fact, they've continued this very successfully, because to meet expectations in the diamond market, they changed their advertising from 1 year or one decade to the next. Mm-hmm. So these things that we hold so true, like the idea of the four C's, the cut, clarity, color, and carat, mm. which is something that any woman buying an engagement ring actually truly thinks about, came to be. At first, they just talked about size, you know, mm-hmm. just the bigger the better. But then when De Beers came into this surplus of very small stones, mm-hmm. they said, okay, we need women to buy these small ones too. So mm. let's emphasize more than just size. And let's create things like the Eternity Band, and now they call it Pave. You know, it's just these like tiny little stones that are pretty much worthless, all smushed together. So they created trends, and they also created, the thing about spending 2 months' salary on an engagement ring came about, I love this, you know, came about in the 80s, because they did take these very careful surveys every year, and they had found that men were spending less money than they wanted on engagement rings. So they asked men, why did you spend what you spent? And they almost all said, well, I just asked my father what he spent on my mother's ring, and then I spent the same. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, that's not going to do at all. So how can we come up with a formula that's a big stretch for everyone? That's mm-hmm. a lot of money, but that, you know, kind of stays in association with what you make. So they came up with this idea of 2 months' salary. And, you know, the ads are so manipulative. You know, they say, like, isn't 2 months' salary a small price to pay for her happiness? And, you know, it's like, I guess. When they brought the same ad campaign to Japan, they said, let's see if we can get it a little higher. So they said, isn't 3 months' salary? And it worked.
I'm Jonathan Meads, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
At the beginning of each section of the book, there's a little piece of information from the air surveys and things. And you're right, they are so cynical. It's amazing reading them.
Yeah.
And that whole... There's a guy in the UK, a documentary maker called Adam Curtis, who's been on this show a couple of times. He made this amazing series called The Century of the Self, which is about the parallel lives of the Freuds and, like, Sigmund Freud, so psychoanalysis, and PR, because one of the members of the Freud family was basically invented the concept of PR. So the idea that consumerism talks about the growth of the advertising agencies and how they invented the idea of conspicuous consumption as well. You know, the very idea that people have this need to go out and buy things was also, you know, a 20th century invention of the advertising industry. And I think that seeing those real documents printed out, it is incredibly, cynical, just like so clinical. Scientific.
And those documents, so these confidential memos that they created every year, because the ad agency was in America, but De Beers, due to antitrust laws, could not be physically present in
America.
That's
so interesting as well. Just elaborate on that. So there are, it was a company set up by Cecil Rhodes in South Africa originally. We'll probably get onto that in a bit. South Africa is, you know, where the vast majority of the world's diamonds were coming from. A company that wants to trade in America but can't. None of its representatives can go to America.
Right,
why is that?
Because De Beers had this monopoly and they were violating American antitrust laws. They could not physically, even one person who worked for De Beers could not physically be present in America doing business. Mm-hmm. So these advertising executives from NWR would go to Johannesburg or to London once a year and meet with these representatives. Mm-hmm. And at that time, to be flying to Johannesburg, especially during World War II, that mm-hmm. would, I mean, they would go every year. It was really kind of an extraordinary thing. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, the story, it's a ridiculous story, but it's true. And it's in the book about Jerry Locke, who was the vice president, who was the one person from the agency who did go. And at one point he was on like a tiny little sort of, not even an airplane, but, you know, what would you call it? Sort of like something like that. It was like a glider type thing that crashed. And his life was saved by floating on the De Beers papers. It's ridiculous. But anyway, so these memos, these confidential memos, I knew they existed because a couple of them had been quoted in this 1982 article in the Atlantic Monthly. And I looked for them and I could not find them. And I was dying to see them because I knew they would really enhance the Francis chapters. Mm-hmm. I was told by one writer they might be at the Smithsonian and someone else said they might be at Harvard. And I looked everywhere. I looked at the NWR archive at the Smithsonian. I looked at every piece of paper. I was looking at dry cleaning receipts from the 60s. I mean, it was ridiculous. And I couldn't find them. So I eventually sort of gave up on the hope of finding them. And then the day before the book was due, it was done. I was going to visit Frances's house in Pennsylvania because the woman who bought it had invited me. I contacted her. She invited me to come for tea. I went for tea. You know, it was wonderful. Walked around the rooms, met the neighbors. Great. And then as I'm leaving, she says, by the way, Frances just left this one box of papers behind when she left, and I never threw it out. If you want it, you can have it. And of course, it contained all of the memos.
So amazing. What a great story.
It was amazing. So I was actually, I've never been so elated in my entire life. You know, as I was driving home, I like stopped in the grocery store parking lot in Pennsylvania, and I'm under the street lamp, you know, looking through the memos, and I just couldn't believe it. And they were, as you said, very cynical and very, you know, very much sort of, what are men's greatest fears about themselves? Okay, let's capitalize on those and get them to buy diamonds as a result.
I've just mentioned Africa, South Africa. Obviously, everybody knows that that's the place where diamonds come from. One of the things I wasn't aware of, that you're talking about the history of De Beers, the company, and the diamond industry, you mentioned the eternity rings. There was this glut of diamonds from Siberia that were on the market. So tell us about that, because that's a story I wasn't aware of.
Yes, and that's where the small stones came from. And this is the case. So De Beers, you know, wanting to and this has actually changed a little bit in just the last few years. De Beers no longer is actually the monopoly in diamonds, and now for that reason they're allowed to have storefronts and actual, you know, places you can go buy a De Beers diamond. But before that, there was no such thing as really a De Beers diamond. You know, you wouldn't buy one per se, but every diamond you bought was a De Beers diamond. So they didn't care about furthering their brand. They just cared about furthering
diamonds.
And every time a diamond mine is found, or was found until a few years ago, actually I think this is still ongoing, De Beers buys it. Even if something is found that they don't want it to be mined, they buy it and they don't mine it. So with Siberia, yes, they thought this was going to be a great arrangement, but it turned out that most of the stones were just tiny and unusable. Instead of not using them, it led them to all these new styles in jewelry. And it's quite funny because today they call it the pavé. It's like the small stones. That is incredibly popular. If you look at almost any young woman will be wearing that sort of a ring. In fact, I'm wearing one. But they're really just kind of these garbage small diamonds. I mean, it's ridiculous.
And, of course, the politics of diamonds comes up in the book as well. People, of course, will know that, you know, a lot of the countries in southern Africa where diamonds are mined are also places where there's constant civil wars going on, and the concept of the blood diamond. So let's talk about this for a little while, the politics of diamonds. This is obviously something that's sort of still going on and is incredibly contentious.
Yeah, and I think that this is an area of the book where, because the book is so much about how a diamond ring can kind of move through the ages and almost take on a life of its own, this is why the character Kate is so critical, because she does have a critical eye about these things, and she sees it as much more than this beautiful little piece of jewelry. In fact, she sees it as this like horrendous thing that she can't imagine anyone wanting. And I guess one of the things I wanted to focus on in the book, of course the diamond ring is the main example, but is kind of the importance that we bestow upon objects and the things we're willing to do or sacrifice for an object. So the violin obviously is another one, and they really range from, you know, little things like James thinking that when his mother dies all he's going to have of her is her really crappy house full of her crappy, you know, smoke smelly objects. And Kate, I think, is just sort of very anti this whole idea, but also this idea that how do you participate in a consumer society without exploitation? Because today, you know, the same countries that were ravaged by diamonds, now it's cell phones and it's Apple products and it's all, no one, you know, there's a type of person in Brooklyn where I live who would never be seen wearing a diamond ring, but they all have MacBooks or whatever they're called, and they all have iPads, and actually those are like the worst human rights violators of our time. So it's kind of like, how do you participate without corruption, without, you know, evil in some way?
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. I'm talking to J. Courtney Sullivan about her novel, The Engagements. And in this part, Courtney, I wanted to talk quite generally about marriage itself, the idea of marriage, the concept. I think what's quite interesting in this book is how it becomes difficult to sort of separate the idea of the patriarchal, traditional, legal idea of marriage from the wedding industry, from the consumerism side, from the diamond engagement rings to just the ever-increasing costs and opulence of people's weddings. And you mentioned the idea that Jeff, one of the characters, the two characters in the gay marriage, becomes something of a bridezilla, as you as you describe it. And he does. He goes absolutely, you know, they want the best wedding they could possibly have with the most expensive place and all of the frills. And he really wants to be a bride with bridesmaids and stuff. And that's fascinating, that idea that people want that sort of opulence.
Yes.
Let's talk about the changing attitudes to what a wedding should be, first of all, and then we'll talk about whether there should be weddings at all.
Right. Yes, it's amazing. I mean, this is a whole other thing. This is like the natural outgrowth of what you were talking about earlier, creating a society of consumers, you know? So now marriage is a consumer event, really. It is. I actually myself got married the week the book was published. I got engaged a year into writing this book, and it took me 2 years to write it. So for a year of it, I was not engaged. I was a Kate-type person. I was just completely, not anti-marriage, but I just thought weddings were ridiculous, and I didn't get it at all. And I was really channeling a lot of my own frustration through Kate. And then a year into it, I got engaged. And suddenly, I sort of understood the madness, because there's so many options. You know, you could spend... you could get a degree in this. I mean, it's crazy. It's like almost like you're learning a brand new language that you're never going to speak after this one day is over. You know, it's just absolutely insane. And I think there's so much expectation from so many different places that you really go insane. I mean, my sort of conundrum with weddings as an attendee was always, they're all the same. It doesn't matter. You know, you can do it on the beach. You can do it in a nice hotel. You could do it at the top of a volcano. It's the same damn thing. You know, it's just the same thing. And everyone tries to be so original. But then, of course, I did the same thing myself. I thought, oh, I want to have the most special snowflake wedding. You know, it's just silly.
I want to have the Brooklyn food cart wedding.
Oh, yes. That was a real wedding someone went to, I was thinking, and it was really cool. My friend went to this wedding, and she was showing me. They just sent out an email, and it had frequently asked questions. And one was like, can we bring our dog? Yes, absolutely, bring your dog. You know, it was just like, what a great idea.
I wasn't going to... I don't normally in a show... I like to talk about the work and not necessarily the writer's personal lives or whatever, but I do think it's unavoidable, that fact that, you know, you got engaged while writing the book and then subsequently married. And while that's changed... You just mentioned how that might have changed your attitudes towards marriage itself. How did it affect... Do you think it had a change in the direction of the book?
No, I don't think so. I think the only thing that was really personally relevant to me was this wedding thing. And it was really funny because I would sort of act like Jeff, where I would be like looking at mason jars with flowers in them on the knot.com for 4 hours. And then I would sort of step out of this like zombie trance and say, who am I? What's happening? Why am I doing this? And so it was like very therapeutic. I would write the whole thing from Jeff's point of view, and then I would write it from Kate's point of view.
Yeah.
And really what I was writing was myself reacting to myself, if that makes sense. But as far as marriage goes, my experience didn't have a huge impact because I wasn't married. You know, I was just sort of thinking about it. And I think marriage is a relationship that's always completely fascinated me as far as writing goes and just thinking about it and observing other people's marriages. So it's probably much more a product of observation than participation at this point.
Talking about, coming from Kate's perspective, you know, writing the character of Kate from that idea of looking at marriage itself as a as an institution, let's talk about that idea. How do you talk in the book about the changing attitudes towards marriage itself?
I think Kate, Kate sees marriage as this hideous thing, and she's very interested in the roots of marriage and the fact that really it was originally kind of a business transaction and the woman was just sort of being handed off. people around her are constantly telling her, those who want her to be married especially, that it's just not that way anymore. Marriage has evolved into a totally different thing. Mm-hmm. But she just feels, well, what is the point of this? Especially given how many marriages fail. Mm. And, you know, I think the other aspect of it that comes out in her father's story, which is just a tiny part of the book, obviously, but, you know, the idea of remarriage, the idea that you'd have a terrible marriage, mm-hmm. it would end, and then you would say, let's do that again, you know? So, and a lot of times that works much better, actually, the second time around. Because you kind of know what you want and what you don't want. But I think, you know, there's a great, this sort of plays into Toby and Jeff and their story. Mm. There's a great Fran Lebowitz quote where she says, why do gay people want to get married and be in the military, which are the two worst things about being straight? And, you know, there's that, I think Kate really is of that mindset.
And I think that's really interesting and understandable because, you know, while I've often thought that myself, why clearly it's unconscionable that gay people have not been allowed to legally have a way to announce their relationship to the world in that way. I have often thought, you know, why, oh, should we not be talking about the idea, I'm married myself, so I can't really comment on this, but, you know, should we not be talking about the idea of getting married at all, whether marriage itself, because although, as you mentioned, it has changed, clearly it has changed in the same way that a woman is not a man's property mm-hmm. any longer, and not necessarily everybody does it, but it still is expected that people would, you know, the woman would lose her surname, you know, and hangovers of that old way do to carry on. And I've always thought the interesting thing about the gay marriage debate, here in the UK we had this thing for a while called civil partnership, mm-hmm. which was like not really marriage but a sort of step towards it, and they were contentious, but I think a lot of people also thought that perhaps civil partnerships was the way that everybody should go. Yes. Like, get rid of marriage,
yes.
and everybody have civil partnerships, and therefore there would be equality in yes. that way, rather than suddenly allowing everybody to get married.
Right. Well, I went to a very liberal college, Smith College in Massachusetts, which is a women's college, and it was really educated, kind of steeped in feminist principles. And I took this class my senior year. The teacher was amazing, and it was called Women and the Law.
Mm.
And one of the, you know, I did for my final paper, I did a paper about this particular Supreme Court case, and it had to do with transgender marriage rights. And so I remember that the teacher wrote on my paper, you know, because I was basically arguing, of course, like, transgendered people should have all the same marriage rights and this is what it should be and blah, blah, blah. Well, she had knocked my grade down half a point and said, this is very well argued, but the one thing you didn't consider is just getting rid of marriage altogether. And actually, that really blew my mind. I had never considered such a thing. And I thought, I didn't even know there was a way to be even more liberal than I already am, but there is.
There's always a way to be more liberal than you already are. Plenty of people will tell you.
Right. But, you know, it is an interesting thing, and it's almost like our world cannot get its head around that idea, so let's just all be married kind of a thing.
I'm John Lloyd, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I think this is rather a laboured comparison, perhaps, but I wanted to try and compare the position of Frances Geraghty in the advertising industry mm. as a pioneering career woman to the position of women writers today in the world of American letters.
Oh.
If I can make such a comparison.
Interesting.
And I love this book, and the book that I was most reminded of reading it, or the genre of books that I was most reminded of reading it, was probably typified by something like The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen, which is mm. ostensibly a domestic saga,
right.
but a densely argued book that takes a wider look at the American condition and important issues
yes.
in American life. And that's what this book is.
Thank you.
And yet, of course, the paperback copy of this that we're talking about now,
mm-hmm.
you know, has lipstick and nail varnish on the cover. Yeah. Looks very much like it's aimed at the women book buying market
yes.
rather than the book buying market. And I think that's underselling it.
Yeah.
And I wondered what your take on that sort of thing is.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it is really, it's a struggle, you know, it's hard. I think it's hard for everyone involved, including the publishers, because mm-hmm. I think usually the publishers, their job really is to sell books. You
yeah,
know?
And they know their market, ultimately, at the end of the day. Yeah.
Right. A lot of times they think, okay, women are going to be the main buyers for this, so we must target it toward women. But I think it's, you know, women are not 4-year-old girls, and they would be just as likely to buy something that is not quite as feminine. Mm. You know, it doesn't have to be so over the top feminine.
Well, I did notice that your earlier books do not have.
Yeah.
They have covers that have. Certainly, Maine has a woman on the front cover, but it's a lot more sort of arty, neutral picture that I think would appeal to a more general audience.
And even as I was writing this book, I was fearful. You know, I was thinking, oh my God, you know, it's going to have a big foil diamond with a heart around it or something on the cover. It's hard. You know, the only sort of good thing about ebooks, it's funny, I found with my second novel, Maine, even though it did have the girl, I agree that the picture was sort of artistic, but it was still a picture of a girl in a bathing suit. And
you will say, this is the book you want to read on the beach, because it was a picture of a woman on the beach.
Actually, the cover had nothing to do with the book. But I had so many men who would write to me and say that they loved that book and that if it had not been for ebooks, they never would have read it because they wouldn't have wanted to be seen with the cover. But, you know, no one knows what you're reading when you've got the Kindle there, so it wasn't a problem. And, you know, that's so troubling. It really is, actually, you know, that a whole section of people is not reading a whole section of literature. Well, not just my books, but many, many people's.
And I think also that women read more novels than men anyway. So I would suggest possibly I haven't done the research and might be completely wrong.
No, that's true.
But Jonathan Franzen probably has more women readers than he does men readers. However, nobody would ever consider putting bright red lipstick on the front cover of a Jonathan Franzen novel.
I don't think so. And, you know, I think that it's probably the closest sort of comparison just as far as topic is Jeffrey Eugenides' The Marriage Plot.
Yeah.
When that came out, I was writing this, so I was very curious to see the covers they gave that and, and then covers that I got.
Another great comparison, because you think back to the, you know, the Virgin Suicides and, you know, the Marriage Plot again, another book that is set in the domestic sphere. You know, it's not about politics. It's not about, you know, it's very much located in the American everyman family situation. But again, is one of those things that people talk about in the context of the great American novel, serious man writer type thing. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's it.
Yeah, and it really it kind of functions on a lot of different levels because for someone like me, it can just be frustration. You know, for a reader, perhaps you're not going to read something that you might have actually really liked. And then I think there's this other kind of scary part of it that I don't know that people necessarily realize is that there are a lot of very ambitious young women writers who don't want to write from the point of view of women because they feel they will be diminished if they do. And that, to me, is really sad and troubling because who else, you know, is going to do that if not you?
Harking back right to what we talked about in the first part of the show, I mentioned writing about Francis and writing about the fictional characters and what was the difference. Mm. So the James and Sheila chapter is written from James's perspective, whereas all the other narrators are women. So how does that, you know, how did you, because you inhabit James entirely realistically. he is a fantastic character.
Thank you. I think it was sort of two things that enabled me to be able to try it. One was that my last novel, Maine, one of the main protagonists is Alice, this grandmother who's really nothing like me in any way. And she's, you know, 83 years old. And after I wrote that book, people really connected to Alice, probably more than any other character I've ever written. Mm-hmm. And so I felt if I could write Alice, I was really as different from her as I am from, you know, a 35-year-old man or whatever. So I felt sort of emboldened, you know, to do it. And the other thing was really, I think, my husband, living with my husband and, you know, I've really come from a world of women. I have one sister. I have no brothers. I went to a women's college. My first job was at a women's magazine. And so I really got into this mindset of women are like this and men are like that. And when I first met my husband, I would say things like that all the time. And he would say, not necessarily. Well, no, some men aren't like that. Some women aren't like that. And so it kind of made me think, oh, right, okay, they're not a different species. It's just a man. You know, I can do it. And so, yeah, I felt very comfortable writing James by that point.
We're out of time. So I've been talking to Jay Courtney Sullivan. We've been talking about her book, The Engagements, which came out at the beginning of January in paperback from Virago Books. So, Courtney, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Kratosky, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So I'm talking to the critic Robert Hanks, and Robert, I've asked you to come up with something for us to talk about. So what are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about Comedians by Trevor Griffiths, the TV film of this, which was broadcast in 1979, directed by Richard Eyre, and starring Jonathan Pryce.
So tell us who Trevor Griffiths is.
Trevor Griffiths is a left-wing playwright, I think it would be fair to say. Comedians was really the sort of high point of his career, I think, in terms of a play that caught the imagination. He writes extremely abstruse, difficult plays these days. I saw some years ago a play he'd done about Danton and the French Revolution, which I just found massively hard. He's written plays about Tom Paine as well. And not long after Comedians was broadcast, he was involved in writing the script for Reds, the big Warren Beatty epic about John Reed, 10 Days That Shook the World, and the October Revolution in the Soviet Union. So he tends to write about weighty political issues and use the lives of weighty political figures as a way of doing it.
You mentioned we're going to talk about the TV adaptation, the Play for Today version. Now, it was a stage play before, so did you first see it as the TV production?
I first saw it as the TV production, and not on its first broadcast. I know that for a fact, because I wasn't actually living in the country when it was first broadcast. So it was repeated at some point in the early 1980s, when I would have been in my late teens, at a very impressionable age, I think it's fair to say, which I think is key to my feelings for it. It's at a point when I was sort of groping my way through art and literature. And it gives you a lot of pointers. It tells you what to think to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Although
it's quite didactic.
Not being told what to think is part of its theme. It's actually telling you how to be told or how not to be told what to think.
So tell us what it's about, first of all, and then we'll come back to how it affected you.
It's a very traditional, strangely, three-act structure. The first act, you meet a gang of aspiring comedians in, I think it's meant to be Manchester, who are all going to an evening bass, which is being taught by Eddie Waters, who was once a famous comedian himself, the Lancashire Lad, but who, for reasons that become clear towards the end of the play, his career has taken something of a nosedive. So although he's still a minor celebrity, he doesn't have much of a career left. So you meet these various comedians who are stereotypes from a joke. There's an Irishman, a Jew. Briefly, there's an Indian. And Gethin Price, the central character, really, he's clearly a Welshman. And so they meet, they're waiting for Eddie to come along and take them. It turns out that they're all going for a talent scout is up from London and is going to take a look at them and see who's going to be a potential professional comic. That's what they're all after. For one reason or another, they all want to be professional stand-ups. And then the second act, we see them performing their acts at a bingo club where you hear the groans of the punters when they're told the bingo is going to stop for half an hour whilst they watch the comedians. And then the final act, they're all gathered back in the classroom again for essentially for recriminations after the evening hasn't gone as well as it could have.
Now, Eddie Waters, as you mentioned, he's like an old, if we sort of date him, sort of music hall style comedian once upon a time. But really what I find quite interesting to look at it from today's perspective is he's like Stuart Lee before his time, isn't he? He's got this idea that it should be about the art. Comedy is a calling and they should be basically performing for their muse and not to make themselves famous and not to make money out of it.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things about it was absolutely prophetic. And I don't know how much actual influence it had. But you sort of imagine that Alexei Sale and every other comic who was coming through the comic strip in the late 70s, early 80s, must have seen it. And it more or less tells you what alternative comedy should be. So it's non-racist. It's never about stereotypes. It's always using the comedy as a vehicle for exploring human nature. You're never trying to get the laughs. The laughs are not the end. They're the means to something else. That's the most important thing. And it has, as well, you see in the character of Gethin Price, he's the star pupil. He's the one who Eddie can see himself in. But he's actually angrier than Eddie, and there's a real kind of rage in him. And you can see that in early alternate comedy. The young Ben Elton, when he was a little bit too political for some of you. And, more specifically, Alexei Sale, who was just fuming with anger. There's a fantastic piece by Ian Hamilton in his collected essays somewhere, actually, or selected essays, describing the comic strip in the late 70s, talking about what it was like in the first encounter with alternative comedy, which, it's amazing reading in the light of this play. You can see what he's describing, something that's exactly what Trevor Griffiths was trying to get at.
all the way you've just described it dates it quite specifically to that period of time of the fight between the alternative comedians and the old style bigoted club comedians that they displaced. Now, the show was revived again a few years ago with some actual comedians in it. And I wonder if how relevant would it be to today's audience? Because those comedians that it's particularly critiquing, the club comedians, that just doesn't really exist anymore. In fact, I guess the only time we're really likely to see those comedians at the moment is if they've been collared by U-Tree and they're up in court or something. You know, we don't tend to see their likes anymore. Or they're in, you know, or they're in the Celebrity Big Brother house or whatever.
Well, it's funny, right, a few years ago I'd have said absolutely those kind of battles had been fought. But I do think I'm one of those who feels that Little Britain in its satire of attitudes to class actually ended up being extremely patronising. You know, there was a certain viciousness in the portrayal of Vicky Pollard and things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there have been other examples where Jimmy Carr as well, you know, his jokes about gypsies and various other things. Some of Ricky Gervais's supposedly jokes about the handicapped. I feel they are, the attitudes are always bubbling under. I mean, the prejudice hasn't died, even if that particular style of comedy, easy acceptance of the prejudice has died.
Yeah, because those later comedians do it with a sort of veneer of irony or sort of knowing, oh, look, I'm being racist, but you all know this is wrong.
Yeah. So there, there's definitely a kind of period element, but I don't think there's anything unrecognisable in it.
Nowadays, it would be more the commerce versus the art. So you've got, I said, your Stuart Lee and your Daniel Kitson's and your Josie Long's on one side, and the, you know, the aforementioned Jimmy Carr and your Michael McIntyre's and the comedians that are doing gags and selling out massive stadiums.
Yeah, well, I mean, that in a way, that's the thing that really dates it, is that they're talking about getting a few bookings in northern clubs and maybe ending up on television, you know, presumably with the comedians, exactly.
Yeah.
terrible ITV program, which is all Frank Carson, it's the way I tell them, and Bernard Manning. And now they'd be a bit more ambitious than that. They would be younger, they would be looking for younger audiences and bigger money. That would be the really big difference, I think.
One of the things that really stuck out to me rewatching this is, I think, you know, we tend to have this idea in terms of entertainment, television entertainment or films, that while we knew that back in the day, back in the 70s, there was You Mind Your Languages and your racist comedy and things, we tend to think that in terms of permissiveness and sort of explicitness, that things are more explicit nowadays. But this play is incredibly explicit. There's a great sequence where they basically dissect, they analyse this limerick about a woman called Pratt.
Yes.
Which has many occasions to say a word that rhymes with Pratt.
Good Lord, are we not allowed to say that?
Oh, no, we can, yeah. Okay. They discuss the meaning of the word twat over and over and over again, which it just seems a bit shocking to me that would have been on the television in 1973 or whatever it was.
79 was it?
79, sorry.
The play was first performed on stage in 75. Which is interesting, because that really is definitely long before alternative comedy took hold. So and see the prophetic element. Yeah, I mean, I think it says something about the degree of sophistication that drama had back then.
That's lacking from today's drama.
Well, I'm afraid it is. I mean, if you look at Richard Eyre, who directed this, you know, and later became director of the National Theatre. I mean, actually, a friend of mine who's a theatre critic once said that if you had to rank Richard Eyre's talents, you'd put theatre director at the bottom and television director and theatre animateur and administrator at the top, and that Richard Eyre would be devastated if anyone ever said this to him. But he directed some fantastically clever, dark television stuff around this time. The Imitation Game, the Ian McEwan play, set in Bletchley Park, which is Harriet Walter as, she's one of the code breakers who gets in a terrible pickle and ends up being accused of spying. And it's really quite dismal stuff and quite grim. And the Insurance Man as well, a terrific Alan Bennett play, which I think is about the only one you can get on DVD, because Alan Bennett is a national treasure, so all his stuff is available. But that's a play about Kafka's life working in an insurance company in Prague in the early 20s. And his life is seen striding along these dark bureaucratic corridors as being very much like the trial. And that, you know, there's a degree of literary sophistication and a kind of emotional shading and shadowing in all this that I don't think you get very often on television now. I don't want to be one of the kind of good old days merchants who says all TV is rubbish now, but I do think there was a volume of stuff came out then. I can just remember so much stuff that was happening then that seemed to me that was one-offs. You know, it wasn't doing a series. It was just saying we're going to throw the resources at one 90-minute film and it's going to be spectacular.
And also, no doubt, the way that this is, it's explicitly Marxist, which is not something you would expect to see on television these days.
Yeah, I mean, an awful lot of that. I mean, as well, you can see old Alan Clarke plays. By the way, a lot of this stuff that isn't available on DVD, you can find up on YouTube. So, for example, Alan Clarke's film Elephant, which is about the Troubles in Northern Ireland. I mean, the point being that murder was the elephant in the room. This was an early use of the phrase before it had become a terrible cliche. I mean, that's just a succession of shootings happening over and over again. You just see murder after murder after murder with very little commentary for about 40 minutes or something. It's a shocking play. And the kind of political implications of it are, without anything being made explicit, anything spelled out, are extraordinary. And I don't think you could make anything that frank now.
Part of the point of choosing to talk about in this thing, A, is to recommend something that people might not have seen, but also talk about something that's a particular influence. And you mentioned at the beginning of the talk about how seeing this play had an influence on you. So let's finish off talking about that.
Yeah, I just think it was... I'm trying to think back to what I was like when I saw this, you know, but I was a kind of very, very bookish boy, very keen on going to the theatre. Around about this time, actually, which is interesting in view of the kind of comedy style that Gethin Price produces. I remember seeing Max Wall in Waiting for Godot at the Roundhouse. And I suppose there was, as I say, this a kind of clarity to the way it talks about art and what it's for. I mean, art should have a purpose. I was reading a lot of George Orwell at this point. Well, you know, George Orwell, in Why I Write, says, you know, he sees that whatever he wrote without a political purpose, what he did was unclear and vague and pretentious. You know, you always need a political purpose. So it gave me that very strong sense, which I'm sorry to say I have never maintained, that you had to see that there was that art has an effect outside itself, and you had to be aware of that effect. And I think, you know, I later encountered... people who seemed to feel that art for art's sake was all very well. And I could never take that seriously. It always seemed to me to make them terribly fluffy and terribly vulnerable to criticism. It really kind of coloured me, and it turned me into a bit of a Puritan, I think, in ways that are both good and bad. I mean, you know, I think wanting what is right, wanting to do good, is, of course, a good thing. Being completely po-faced about it, possibly not.
We should reiterate the sequence, the routine that Gethin Price does in this play is, it's the sort of ultimate expression of comedy as truth, as an angry demonstration, as you said, perhaps would one day influence Alexis Sale, but it's also, it's excruciating.
Yeah, you can imagine being in the audience at the Bingo Hall. Imagine being in the audience at Nottingham Playhouse when it was first performed, actually, and not knowing what the hell was going on here. It's very strange, very alienating, and but it does have some fantastic moments in it. And there's this one beautiful thing. What he does, he's white-faced. He's a clown, but with a strange punky hairstyle. And he's got a pair of dummies on stage in evening dress, and they represent the ruling classes. And he's desperately trying to attract their attention, and all they can do is call for a taxi, wanting to get away from him. And he becomes more and more violent and enraged as the ruling classes ignore him. And there is one point when he turns to the audience, or turns to the camera, and says, "Some would say this is envy. It isn't. It's hate." And I thought that's a great line. That phrase, the politics of envy, I've always loathed as a way of dismissing real angst and real anger about class distinction. I think it's a pathetic phrase, and that's the best retort I've heard to it.
We've been talking about The Comedians, then, by Trevor Griffith, which, as Robert said, you can find in its entirety on YouTube at the moment, so do check it out. So, Robert, thank you very much for talking to us about it.
Neil, thank you very much for asking me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.